is Goodman speaking, and we all just heard that message. Our call is being recorded. Thank you. So, as far as scope of work, when we first talked before, we of course were going through the document line by line, and that seemed to get us some traction. We were going in the right direction. We also do for today have a number of items on the agenda specifically. So going back to that review, that whole review that is appropriate, if we can hold that for later in today's meeting and future meetings so that we can get through some of the items that are agendized. So with that in mind, if we could look, we do have some background info as well, some of the things we asked staff that were on the minds of the committee members that will be helpful for all parts of today's discussion. And so if we can move to item number 6 and discuss the reports of adverse occurrences and see if we can be at that part of the agenda for now.
Nick, if I could, this is Ryan again, just to
please
announce. So we got a couple of different phone calls regarding this report in particular. There was a request to delineate further, and it was, I'll tell you, it was a challenge, but only because we've lost staff and the person that put together the report, Miriam Thompson, is no longer here. We could probably reduplicate the report, but in the time frame that we had to change the report. And in reality, what the delineation was to state there was like 17 different adverse occurrences that occurred. And of the 17, 9 of them were 1301 permit holders. And of the 9 1301 permit holders, how many of those were oral maxillofacial surgeons versus somebody else? And if that's the pleasure of the committee, I think we could still probably go back and get that information. But I think that maybe for purposes of the committee and the direction of the committee, we probably should just, I don't know, hopefully this is enough information that we could probably make changes to this, to the rules and perhaps even statute moving forward. But I don't know that capturing information from a rear view mirror is going to be completely helpful in moving the direction forward as we try to make changes to the anesthesia rules. I could be wrong, but I would, and I'll do whatever the pleasure of the committee would like to see further if you want it delineated further.
All right. Thank you very much for that. For those that had the interest in this report, those that have, you know, of course, hopefully of all of us have been able to review it, with what Mr. Edmondson is saying, do we feel comfortable with this level of reporting, at least for the understanding of the past?
I'd say that you prefer probably a bit of depth. And look at this report. I would suggest that we go back further and that the emphasis on kind of what's happened in our state as the change statutes from prior to the 2012 changes and post 2012. So I would request that we actually go back further. Just I think this is 2015, and the documents reflect that, as well as the permits and what happened with the patients and things like that. And I'm not sure if the staff would need assistance, but, you know, maybe there should be some kind of a cohort of individuals that looks at these things and in particular should include with some knowledge to help, understanding of some things that have happened. I think for staff just to put a bunch of numbers down on the document maybe doesn't provide us all information.
Yeah, this is Christensen here. I'd like to see it further delineated to as far as permit holders were concerned. That would be beneficial.
This is German speaking. I tend to agree. I think that we're being tasked as a committee to really look over the details of this policy and potentially change the details of how anesthesia is administered in dental offices. And if we are unable to look at the details of the problems we're currently having, I think it's difficult to make those changes in good faith.
Yeah, this is Ali Bagai. I'd also be interested to know, you know, we know that one of these 17 was a death, but what was the adverse occurrence in the other 16? You know, what was the severity of the adverse occurrence, and you know, what was the result for the patient? I'd like to know a little more information.
Seth, if I could, this is Ryan. Quick question. All of these cases, and I don't know to what outcome that they went, but they've all gone through a complaint procedure and then ended in something. Some of them may have ended in discipline and some of them may not have. I don't know. But how much of that information, because if they're dismissed, the whole file is confidential. So I don't know exactly. And to be honest, and I'll just be frank, I think we've tried to come with a couple reports a couple of different times, and each time we bring a report, there's more delineation. I'm not sure exactly where we're going, other than some of this may be confidential, and I'm not sure exactly how much more we can share, other than we might be able to do the delineation as far as how many were 1301 permit hold, or of the 1301 permit holders, who was an oral maxillofacial surgeon. We might be able to do that, but all of the other details of the cases may not be one readily available, but also may be confidential.
This is German. Ryan, I think if correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought we had discussed this and actually questioned our legal counsel in our last committee and queried this information, and I understood that it was approved that we could obtain the details of the cases.
Well, that's going to depend upon what the outcome was. Statutes provide for different issues of confidentiality depending upon how the case was resolved. So without having that information, specifically for each case, it's kind of tough on the fly to say, okay, we can talk about the details of this one, but not that one.
This is Brady. I have a question. Is there a way to de-identify the information so that we only have the substance? I mean, I really care less what specialty they come from, but more so what was the stem of the situation and how, really the stem of the situation, I mean, how it was managed, whether it was managed appropriately or not, really comparing that to the regulations to see if there's a regulatory change that would cause an effect or differences to look forward. I think that's the most important part of any of this information. But I don't know if there's a way to de-identify those cases where we can do like shared learning from those experiences to dissect down what went wrong.
This is Blazek. I would echo Brady and Dr. German both, and everyone keeps saying the same thing. And so I think my question would be, I know that every state has different laws, but certainly California produced a phenomenal report about adverse outcomes in their state, and Texas did the same thing. We have those reports as a guideline. And furthermore, it is more about the delivery of anesthesia and adverse outcomes, which are occurrences that we define in our own statute when an occurrence is supposed to be reported. It's not always about a death, or it's not always about a permanent morbidity. It's about someone who's reported an adverse occurrence. And that is, I know the board has all those occurrences. And to be able to look at those occurrences with anesthesia providers and make it a learning experience, I don't see why Arizona should be any different. And it may give us a red flag, it may say, hey, here is a red herring that we didn't see, and this is how we have to address statutes to make delivery of anesthesia safer. And it's not about the permit holder, but it's about the method of how the anesthesia is delivered. One person, two person, whatever, age of the patients, things like that. Those are important data points.
This is Brady.
I don't have to beat a dead horse again, but I mean, we're just asking staff to create this report that really doesn't have a lot of experience in. I'm sorry to hear.
So the only thing I would wanted to add to, and not to go off to on a big tangent with this, but I echo Dr. Blasek's concerns, because this is how we do learn, and we're blinded and have the blinders on. I know in general aviation, this was a big problem for them. And the way that they had to overcome this hurdle with the FAA and reporting events was to have a mechanism where people could report anonymously, and they do that through the Aviation Safety Foundation, through NASA, that NASA actually generates these near misses types of report, but it generates a certificate for them, and it also generates the entire case, and it de-identifies all parties involved. And from that information, they're able to see what was trending, what people were missing, and be able to produce white papers that were sent out and actually had an impact on safety, a tremendous impact on safety. And it also gave them a situation where if a pilot had some kind of violation and they had the certificate in hand, as long as they meet certain metrics, when they went to be challenged by the FAA, if they had that NASA report, they would show leniency. It would show that they had a concern to be able to bring it up to the public's information to the public. I wish Arizona or some of these states would have some type of way or mechanism to be able to identify these cases and have them be able to do a community reporting that would help aid with this. I do see that this state is challenging, even amongst this anesthesia panel, to really get to the meat of the issues because of those confidentiality agreements and things that would become masked if they go one direction, for us to really identify things that are happening in our community.
All right. So this is Goodman. And what I can share is that it's rather clear from a broad swath of clinicians that more information is wanted. And so what we will do is ask staff to take another look at it, see what additional information can be given. As the non-clinician in the virtual room, 17 is a really hard number to draw conclusions from out of a state of 7 million people. Yeah, okay, there's only thousands of anesthesia cases. Well, someone here will probably correct me. Maybe it's more than thousands, but I'm quite sure that's the case. Nevertheless, it's a finite group. Let's allow staff to take another look at it, and let's move on to some of the other topics so that we can continue to proceed. And some of these differences, strong differences of opinion based on training and degree, will continue throughout these discussions. So we'll have an opportunity to continue those differences. Nevertheless, let's move on to point seven. Was based on the request that we research what's happening elsewhere, essentially. And so we have this report, an opportunity to be able to see what's happening elsewhere, hopefully have the Excel file. Now would be a good time for us to be able to review this, ask any clarifying questions, and discuss the merits of this report, and if this report is giving us the information that we're looking for at this time as a committee.
I'm just bringing the report here. Give me a second. But overall, I think it was good, and I thought that the book that was provided, where it went through all the different states, anesthesia guidelines and requirements, I mean, that's extremely helpful knowledge. The book was great. I will look forward to reading it. I think it's going to be an interesting read.
Thank you. For the good of the order, anyone else have thoughts on this, or is this giving us the background, broad information we were hoping to receive?
I would say yes. We have the information we want. It gives us an idea about the hours required in each state and what have you. I can't see any more research doing a lot of good on that. That's just my comment.
Thank you.
Dr. Brady. Thanks, Blasek. Thanks. I put this Excel sheet together in preparation for the same kind of resources that we need with Mississippi. So hopefully it outlined it. I mean, there may be something that a state has changed since then or looked up, a little bit of nuances of difference. But I think this broad brush is fairly accurate and gives us a perspective of what to look at.
All right. Thank you. And appreciate those efforts and the contribution. So we will move to item number 8, review and discuss mobile permits versus multiple office location permits. So this is one of the meatier matters and part of the overall discussion, and turn it over to the clinicians and those in the room that have comments and thoughts on this.
Does anybody happen to know what page of the documents they sent to us that would be under the statutes off the top of their head? I know that the permit pages start on page 10, or the current statutes page 10. And all permit holders start on page 90. So if you go to page 90.
And Dr. Blasek, are you speaking of from the PDF file that has 387 pages?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Thank you.
So this is Ryan. It looks to me, we didn't actually bookmark something specifically to 8, but if you start at the 1301, that's where the permit for 1301 begins. And then I'm trying to look here for.
So page 42 of our document.
Yeah. And then scrolling through that goes through all of anesthesia. I'm going to double check a different document that I have. Give me just one second. So I think mobile permits are discussed under 1301. This is hard to. D5, which would be on our page.
Looks like page 49.
I'll just trust you, Nick.
We'll see. Yeah, I think that at least looks like B5 under 13. Oh, that's under 1303. That, my apologies. I misled us all.
Oh, yeah, it comes under 1302. Actually, it comes under 1302.
All of them.
It's actually on all of them because it says it under on page. Each section has it, but it essentially starts on the first page you said, which was 41. And then scrolling through, I don't see it off the top of my head, but probably the same. It's D5 for each section. So 44, it's D5. Page 49, the one that you have addressed, is for 1302, and it's also D5.
There's also on page 21, Article 8, mobile dental facilities and portable dental units. Is that it looks like that might be the initial definitions that then goes into 1301, 2, 3, and 4. But I could be mistaken if this is not the.
No, that's correct. That's the definition of what mobile dental facilities are.
Well, I think it's great that we have at least three providers on the call here that do mobile. I'm pretty sure Dr. Brady does, Dr. Brandstein does, and Ali does too. I can tell you one of my concerns about mobile anesthesia is in the state of Arizona, that's kind of hard to store that equipment in your vehicle. So just out of curiosity, what do you guys do?
This is Brady. So we do have, when I transport with equipment, there are things that are temperature sensitive, just like we have extreme heats. I have a bag that's dedicated just for things that are temperature sensitive that travel with me inside a climate controlled situation. And so we have to be cognizant of that. Most everything else, though, as far as equipment, we transport it and it does just fine. We also do a systems checks before we ever start the day as well for everything that, you know, that could get jostled or could have broken a sample line or something to that nature. And I do like the mobile permit. It suits me well. I think some of the benefits of it is that if you were to require every office to have all of those requirements, you would get mostly the bare minimums to meet standards or requirements, where a lot of us that are doing this as our profession, we're going to choose the $12,000 monitor that has agent analysis and arrhythmia analysis and everything else with those bells and whistles. But there is a concern as far as transport, and I think that being cognizant of those heat sensitive materials and knowing when to transport them in a bag and not leaving them in your vehicle is a fair argument. But I know the way that I practice, I do think that it's a very safe way of transporting to and from the office to a mobile site. And we see this too in veterinary medicine and hospice and outpatient care with other industries as well.
And Dr. Brady, go ahead, Dr. Brownson.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate that it's also much easier for us to take care of equipment versus having a setup in every single office and, maintenance of multiple offices becomes extremely difficult. It's much easier to maintain equipment, have annual checks and so forth if we have one set of equipment that we're bringing into the various offices.
Thank you. Yeah, and
I was just going to say, we do things a little different with our group as far as we have an employee. We have a central location where we store all of our heat-sensitive items. Well, we store everything there in an air-conditioned facility, and we have an employee that delivers the carts every day. So they're not ever sitting in a hot car.
This is right, Christian, well, too. I've always wondered, too, about those that travel and provide anesthesia, do they have any trained anesthesia assistants they take with them, or how do they train their teams to work in an anesthesia environment and with patients? I'm just curious.
This is Brady. Sorry. I wish this feature had like a raise hand, because I don't know if I'm like chiming in before somebody else, but I don't know if Google Meet has that. Yeah. Like, hi. But, you know, that varies between provider and provider. I mean, for me, for some of us, we're attendings at other universities and we have residents. Others have also an assistant that travels along with us. We also have redundancies in that the dentist or the pediatric dentist has their credentials and we train with them. So, you know, as far as the staffing goes, when something like a crisis management situation was to happen, we would be the ones on the lead for managing those crisis management with the resources that we have at those offices. But yes, it does kind of vary between different types of providers. And even at a stationary facility, you're going to have those challenges where, you know, a system may get go off to new employment, a new assistant's coming in for calibration. I do feel very confident in our teams that we generate, and we also, and this isn't everyone, but a lot of us will also do a monthly type of crisis management scenarios and talk shop, that we understand where they're at and they understand our language as well. And we do that kind of on a continuous cycle. And once we get kind of established with our base of offices, we typically only have about 10 to 12 core offices, and we tend not to go away from those offices. But that's probably year 3, 4, 5 into our presence or getting rooted into our system.
So for the purposes of our review and our recommendations to the board, are we looking at this as something where we need to make stronger specific recommendations on, hey, clinician, don't mess up the medications by leaving it in a hot car? Or is that something that we can determine is already covered well under the licenses of the parties that would cause some real damage and hurt patient safety if they were neglectful enough to leave something in a hot car?
This is basic. And I would have to say it probably doesn't hurt to have something like that. It's not much unlike we're saying, hey, you better keep a accurate record of your drugs that you use. But the thing I'm kind of running through my mind is, and I would defer to Dr. Brady and Dr. Brown and Ali, because I know you guys do this. Is there a way for us to tie this 1301 and the 1304 in terms of, I'd imagine that's where, I mean, I know, Jeff, you would come to my office and do anesthesia in a second, you know, and we have all our stuff here. But I would imagine the majority of the places that you go, they don't have the permit. So they have the 1304. And I'm just throwing it out like something at the wall for us to think about. Is there a way to tie the 1301 and the 1304 together? That would, you know, that's different than what you mentioned, Mr. Goodman, about the, you know, recommendation for medications. But as I read through these statutes time and time again and try to think of where we should make changes, because I thought we were doing okay to begin with, I say, well, there's some redundancy. Most of the guys, 1304s, the reason they have them, I would think, is because they want someone like Brady or Jeff to come to the office and put people. Or am I wrong in thinking that's kind of how it goes?
If I can interject, this is Sherry, board staff. If Dr. Brownstein wanted to come to Dr. Blazik's office, he doesn't need to have anything because he's already a permit holder. The 1304 will come into play only if it's a CRNA or a medical anesthesiologist. That office is required to have a permit. But anybody that is a permit holder can go to another dental office and provide anesthesia.
Yeah, that's, thank you, Sherry, for the clarification. So actually, you guys don't have to do it. Okay, I didn't realize that. Goodbye.
Okay, so our opportunity here on item 8 was for us to review it, and at least at this point, outside of, you know, as we get back to a process of going line by line, at least at this point, sounds like as a group we're generally comfortable with what's in the mobile permits versus multiple office location permits. Okay, we will proceed. Let's move on to item number 9, review and discuss automated external defibrillators, AED, make it easy. So where are we at on this and recommendations around this for change and for the board? Dr. Brady, is all good, huh?
Yeah, I really think everyone should have an AED. I mean, we're dentists. Sometimes we want to be called doctors. Every dentist, if they're giving local anesthetics, should have resuscitative devices and equipment in the office.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is something I mentioned at the last meeting, that is just something that I've come across being in dental offices, that there's no requirement that a dentist have an AED. And yeah, when you're injecting local anesthetic, especially local anesthetic with epi, you have a patient with coronary artery disease, you get an intravascular injection, their heart rate jumps up and they have an MI, and I think we're probably going to upset some dentists if we require them that they have to buy a $1,200 piece of equipment, but in the name of patient safety, it's probably the best idea.
And I am now, I visually can see you. I'm logged in online. You don't get to see my beautiful face at this moment. With that, it looks like there's a great level of agreement on this. And if the level of urgency is such, some of these types of matters, and Ms. Biggs or Mr. Edmondson could correct me, some of these types of matters can be directed by the board to dentistry, and not wait for rule changes. That quite possibly, a letter can be sent out essentially, and Ms. Biggs could give me the right language. But so we could choose to give the feedback to the board of, look, if you're doing any anesthesia, now's the time to get that AED machine. It's right medicine or right dentistry. Mr. Edmondson, how much poop did I step in there?
Not a lot, just a little tiny piece. It's cat poop this time. So, so Seth will help me, but we can do anything, but you won't have any authority to require that dentists have it until there's a rule change. So we can send out, okay. We could do like a blast email to state that it's recommended by the board that all dentists carry an AED in their office, or if they're like mobile permit, as we were just discussing, if they're giving anesthesia. So we can make it a recommendation, but there was no teeth to it, and we can't hold somebody accountable. I mean, you could based on the rest of the procedure, but not simply because they don't have an AED until the rules change.
Sure. So for simplicity, Mr. Edmondson, if you could have staff put it on the next board agenda at my request, and then we can discuss it at the board level and go from there. I don't know if we have to belabor the point here. It seems pretty clear, everybody on the committee. Yeah, $1,200 to save a life is the right thing.
This is Lout. Just for clarification, this is for all dentists to have these, not just the ones that are doing sedation, just all general dentists and the specialties. Anybody that's delivering local anesthesia is required to have one, correct?
Well, the board would have to make the decision.
Okay.
As far as the rule, we can make a specific recommendation around the rule. Okay. What I'm asking staff to do as far as the board is put it on the agenda so that the board can discuss it. Otherwise, it can't be discussed. For this group, is it something that we're thinking rule-wise dentistry needs an AED, or are we thinking when anesthesia is involved? I guess our scope is really to make recommendations around anesthesia, although we can try to say what we want.
This is Loud again. I would recommend it to all dentists, and the reason I do that is the near emergencies that we've ever experienced in our offices are usually grandparents. It's not the kids, it's not the patients, but it's usually grandparents that come in. They're stressed because they're in a dental office, or they've been rushed to get the grandchild to the office. So I would tend to lean that this would be a requirement of all dental offices.
Yeah, with the thought that it's a place of care that maybe provides some safety. Okay, so Dr. Brady, you raised your hand there too.
Sorry, I know I'm talking a lot. I apologize, but one of the things in the recommendation you can even as a pointer to is if you look at your local anesthetic package insert, it said at least 7 different times that you have to have resuscitative equipment on board, such as oxygen and an AED. if you're to administer local anesthetics for that purpose. So the FDA finds it important enough to have it in their package insert multiple times. It may be a good reference pointer for the board to consider.
Thank you.
If you have it at Safeway and Costco, you should have it in your office, period.
Oh, I sure hope dentists start carrying Prime Rib. Awesome. I'm teasing you, Dr. Blake. All right. So as far as rule concerned, Mr. Edmondson, is this something that we would we can put as a general thought in, at least to the anesthesia portion of it, in recommendation that, from the committee?
Yeah, so I'll defer again to Seth on this, and feel free to jump in, Seth. Anything that this committee wants to do as far as recommendation to the board can hear the recommendation. The issue is if there's, and I think that some of us were part, not me, but some of the folks on this call were part of a previous committee, or at least know of the previous committee that set the current anesthesia rules. That could take, at that time, I think it took 5 or 6 years, if I remember from Kevin Earle's position, that it took 5 to 6 years. So if this is something that's important, it may be good to go ahead and open a rule package, at least address this issue, and then open another rule package in the future for more information. Seth has unmuted himself. I'm sure he's got additional comments to that.
Well, if you know, the committee can make whatever recommendations to the board, then the board will decide what, if anything, to do with that. So if it's something that the committee thinks is appropriate to proceed with, you can make that recommendation to the board.
Okay, so this is an item that should be on the next board meeting agenda, per my earlier request. So as a committee, how are we doing this? 6 months is a long time to remember. Are we doing formal motions in this committee, or are we just, you know, I concur? What's the best route at this point, Mr. Edmondson?
Just for ease, go ahead, Seth.
Well, if they're going to make a recommendation, it would have to be through a motion.
Okay. Yeah, so if we could hear a motion for a recommendation back to the board on this matter of AEDs so that we can have a vote on it.
I'll make a motion that we go to the board and recommend all dentists to have AEDs in their office.
I'll second it, Brady.
Thank you both. We've got a first and a second. And so for a vote, all in favor, please share aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, please say nay. Ayes have it there, that part. Okay, say nay. It looks like a consensus that we should take this to the board of the AED matter and as put in the motion. So thank you as a group for that. To move on to point 10, our item here is to review and discuss 1304 permit recommendations from the board's chief investigative consultant, Dr. John W. And I say his name wrong in person, so I'm not going to say it wrong on the phone. All right.
It's Devkin. You're close.
There you go. Doing the best I can, doctor. All right. So we, for this item, let me myself pull it up, and if others can as well. The document's here basically at the end of our packet, right, Dr. Devkin?
Yes. It's a simple 2-page. It's not real long. What I think is unique to my perspective is I have done expert witness work in 35 different states. I've seen 18 adverse outcomes, of which 9 were oral sedation related. I get to see these problems kind of firsthand. And one of the problems I see, and what I've identified, and I spoke at the ADA meeting when they had 2016 to help change the rules for the ADA, was that it's the people that have no training at all are the people that tend to make the biggest mistakes. So if you have a totally untrained dentist in sedation who's doing the preoperative analysis, they're looking at the malapati, they're looking at the Brodsky, they're looking at the patient, and they're not realizing what they need to know in order to sedate the patient. What occurs is, and we've seen this several times, and just this year we've seen a couple of adverse outcomes, but we're noticing that a provider, a dentist anesthesia provider, will come in and may not have all the information that they need because they didn't do the preoperative workup on the patient, and subsequently you have an adverse outcome. And it could be simple, something as simple as a patient that may have had a tracheotomy when they were young and you didn't know it, and it wasn't listed on their health history, you didn't do any workup, you didn't follow up with a physician, you're relying on the dentist who has no training at all to ask the right questions, and you end up with a adverse outcome. To me, what I look at and say, okay, you have anesthesiologists and CRNRAs have to have a 1304 permit or somebody with some training as to identify what the pitfalls are. Well, a dental anesthesiologist who has a dental 1301 permit doesn't have the same parameters. So what you're saying is it's okay for this group, but not okay for this group. And I can tell you that the medical anesthesiologists are going to complain because they have just as much training or more training than maybe a dental anesthesiologist. So my biggest complaint and probably my biggest thought is that you need a team of people. You need people, you need more than one person in an emergency. I mean, my team is trained. One person dials 911. You've got another one that's going to do airway. You've got another one that's going to do CPR. You got another one that's going to grab the defibrillator. You have everybody who's got training to do a job. How is one person going to do the job? And how is one person who didn't do the workup going to be able to know what's happening with that patient preoperatively? So if you think about it, how many anesthesiologists are in the group here? Three? I don't know, three.
There's four anesthesia providers.
Four anesthesia providers. And correct. When you come into...
That's incorrect. There's more than four. There's four that are consist of dentist anesthesiologists, CRNAs, RNMD physician.
If you have a dentist who has training, some training or extensive training in anesthesia, they're going to select a patient that is right to be sedated in the office. They're going to look for the pitfalls and be able to say, you know, maybe this patient isn't the right patient to be sedated in the office. They're going to be asking the right questions on the health history to make sure that you don't miss some type of interaction, that you're not missing something that would be significant. And for me, that is a very touchy subject because I wrote a paper with one of the practitioners out of North Carolina, deaths in the dental office, that was submitted at the International Anesthesia Committee. And what we noticed was that overdoses and inpatient proper selection were the two biggest reasons that deaths happened in the dental office. And you know, is patient selection is everything. If a patient needs to be hospitalized or into a hospital setting, that's where they need to go. And how would you know that if you're relying on somebody who has no training at all? That's really my biggest beef. But go ahead, Dr. Brady.
Okay, so just a few things, and not to push back too hard, but really the buck stops with the anesthesia provider to make those clinical judgments, whether it's a go or no go. I can care less who worked up my patient. I'm always going to work up my patient before seeing that patient. That is the responsibility of all anesthesiologists and all anesthesia providers. So regardless if the dentist had training or not for pre-screening of selection, I'm going to contact those patients well beforehand and get that history for that patient. And if there's other things that are contributing to that health history report, I may seek to get information from different specialists or their primary care physician to make the clinical judgment whether it's a go or no-go decision. There's no way that I'm diverting that responsibility, nor should any anesthesia provider divert that responsibility to somebody else. You are the anesthesia provider. You are the one that makes that decision, whether it's to go or to no go. I do see what you're talking about as far as that team perspective or them having some kind of information or background for crisis management and having those regulations in place to make sure that either that dentist or that pediatric dentist or whomever has PALS or ACLS and have some kind of minimum standards to help with the rescue as far as the team. But we are working with another dentist licensed provider that's there that should have some baseline of that education to help with the crisis management, should have some routines. I definitely can get on board with that. But I seriously, like, we shouldn't think that an anesthesia provider is not working up their patients. If not, that's an anesthesia provider issue completely.
And Dr. Brady, I'm with you. You know, in medicine, we bring in anesthesia for procedures in office settings as well. And we know the criteria that anesthesia has, so we do end up helping with the selection. But we've had cases same day canceled of something that somehow maybe the information changed between when we talked to the patient and when she talked to the person doing this the case in the office. And that, I think, overall in all these discussions, we do have to continue to remember that the part of anesthesia that's being done, that individual is at risk, licensed, and has a duty to protect the community as well. So we can't forget that. We can add rules, we can change rules, we can improve rules, but, you know, to take advantage point of there aren't already rules in place in some way to make sure those licensees stay licensed or have accountability, that would be a little different than how we maybe should proceed. But I think where Dr. Dovkin's coming from is very much a, hey, these are the reports, this is the information, this is what he's able to find and see that, and again, patient safety. So other comments that we have today on this document?
Dr. Dovkin, thanks for being here with us and everything and presenting it. But I think that what you would find if you sat down with the four anesthesia providers and Dr. Christensen and myself, that you have brought up what the inherent problem of the 1304 permit is. That you have a general dentist who calls anybody and says, I need you to come to my office and put this patient to sleep. And I am a general dentist, as is Dr. Brownstein and Dr. Brady, and we can tell you we have no training. I'm sorry, Dr. Loudon also. We have no training in dental school that tells us how to select a patient for anesthesia. We've never worked in the hospital. We don't understand patient workup. And many of our colleagues struggle with simple things like Plavix, Eliquis, simple items. They can't even handle it. So, ironically, you've stumbled onto one of the biggest issues with the 1304 permit. And I wholeheartedly agree with Dr. Brady and with Mr. Goodwin that changing the verbiage is not the answer to the problem. So that's my two cents about it.
Okay. I wasn't saying eliminating a 1304. What's happening is a general dentist now doesn't need any permit if they have a dental anesthesiologist come in, as opposed to a medical anesthesiologist or CNRA can only go to a 1304 permitted office. So what you're saying is the rules are different for a dental anesthesiologist than they are for a medical anesthesiologist or a CNRA. You're bypassing it.
Well, in some sense, this is Brady. Sorry. I'll be real quick. The 1304 permit is to be able to permit a actual non-dentist license and permit. If that didn't exist, then that same CRNA would be able to have an adverse event, the board would have no repercussions or be able to investigate for that 1304 permit and wouldn't preclude him to go to another office. I think that the design of the 1304 permit was to have the abilities for non-permitted, non-licensed anesthesia providers to have those services. So I think it's like a comparison to apples and oranges a little bit in that sense. We still, as 1301 permit holders, still have to go through the process, the vetting process, the same as the 1304, but to a 1301 level, and also have all of our systems in check. And we also have to go through the scrutiny of an evaluation.
This is Brownstein. I think the alternative to having a 1304 is going to be to have some sort of permit for CRNA or physician, where the dental board has some power to, punish an instance or have them present in front of the dental board. And, you know, at this point, the dental board says that they just don't have that power.
Hey, this is Ali Bagai. A couple of thoughts. One, I agree with what Dr. Brady said. It's the anesthesia provider's responsibility to review patients in advance. For our practice, when a dental office requests us, we obtain information on the patient. We review their history. We ask for clearances as necessary from, you know, cardiology, pulmonology, whoever it is, based on the patient's history. We obtain lab work. We call the patient in advance to conduct a preoperative assessment before the day of the procedure. So I definitely agree it's on the onus of the anesthesia provider to have that responsibility, but it is a shared responsibility, as you mentioned, and Dr. Dovgan, between the dentist and the anesthesia provider that comes in. And I recognize the issue as well, as far as who can go into dental offices and what consequences there'll be and who's going to manage those consequences. I took a little bit of a different angle on a solution that I thought of, which kind of mirrors a little bit of what Dr. Brownstein said, and I'm not sure if the folks on the committee had a chance to review the red line that I sent in to create a certification for providers that go into these 1304 offices. And I will also add, as far as regulating providers, ultimately, if an adverse outcome happens in a dental office with a 1304 permit and it's a physician anesthesiologist there, they are going to be regulated and be subject to the disciplinary actions of the medical board. And if it's a CRNA, they'll be disciplined by the nursing board. So there's still regulatory bodies that will make sure that people are providing safe practice. But I think there's certainly a problem here in the 1304, and this definitely pulls on that. But I do think it's the responsibility of the anesthesia provider who's going to be, you know, administering the anesthesia to evaluate the patient in advance for whether or not they're a proper candidate to be done in a dental office.
And I don't mean to interject. I'm agreeing it's always the ultimate responsibility of the provider who's doing the anesthesia. And it will be vicarious liability for the dentist, whoever that may be. I'm just pointing out that the rules are different for a dental anesthesiologist than they are for the medical anesthesiologist, CRNA, only by the fact that an office doesn't need anything right now for a dental anesthesiologist to come in and provide anesthesia. I mean, they have nothing. They can have no defibrillator, nothing. If you have a 1304 permit, they have to have at least training and they have to have on-site inspection to know that they have the proper equipment. So you're taking an office with nothing or an office that has some equipment and some training. And that's my big beef.
Dr. Govgan, with that dental anesthesiologist, we have somebody that has full accountability for licensing to the board, whereas some of these others, we have to create structure that we then can have some accountability. You know, for the medical anesthesiologists, for the CRNAs, yes, they're accountable to their boards, but our patient safety responsibility, we have to have ways to do it. So there is a genuine difference in how we hold them accountable because they are licensed through us.
This is Hero. I think this was part of Dr. Blazek's point, and I agree with it, is, and frankly, Dr. Brady's. The 1301 permit is both allowing the board regulation over the provider and assessing their ability to provide anesthesia. The 1304 permit is providing the board a means to regulate the provider, but it's not really assessing the dentist's knowledge base with anesthesia. So to me, the bigger issue with the 1304 permit is that you can have a general dentist obtain it that has zero background in anesthesia and airway management. Yes, they have to take ACLS and PALS once every 2 years, but other than that, there's no real experience or training that they're required to have in order to work with an anesthesia provider, whereas the 1301 permits are being assessed in their ability. They are required to have experience and training to do it. So I think there's two different conversations that are happening right now. One is the purpose of the permits being a means for the board to oversee the provider, and two, the provider's ability and knowledge base and experience in anesthesia. So I guess my point being is that the 1301, and we're not fully diving into this yet, but my point being the requirements for a general get dentist to get a 1304 permit are pretty mild. And I think that's a topic that we're going to need to dive into at some point. Should they be beefed up? Should these general dentists that are bringing in anesthesia providers be required to have a little bit more, show that they have more experience and training in order to do so?
At least thank you for listening to my perspective and listening to what I see as a expert witness and a 1303 permit evaluator. I just wanted to let you know what I'm seeing, what I think the health, welfare, and the safety of the public is involved, and a little bit of why I think that an office that's providing outside anesthesia needs a 1304. They need to have something as opposed to nothing. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. And Dr. Blazek?
I just go back to our study we're talking about. And I think if we did a comprehensive study where we looked at, you know, what kind of occurrences were happening prior to the 1304 permit and what kind of occurrences have been happening since the 1304 permit, it would be interesting. Because prior to the 1304, all dentists were required to get a permit equivalent to the level of antibiotic that they wanted to provide in their office. And all the dentists I see here, I know they remember those times. And we would have to go out and we would put a general dentist office through the same pace as we put an oral surgeon through when he wanted a 13, when he wanted to put someone to sleep, even though he wasn't doing it himself. And it forced him to have higher training. So I think if you compare the adverse occurrences prior to 2012 or 13, whenever it was, 1304, and since then, that may provide a summation of exactly your mentioning, Dr. Duggan.
I can tell you that the two most recent adverse outcomes, one did not have a 1303 permit or any permit, and the other one had a 1304. So those are the two most recent. Thank you.
Thank you. I think as far as today's discussion, definitely Dr. Dubkin's input and what he's recommending that we recommend back to the board is timely and definitely part of our discussion. The challenge, as has been referenced, this is much of what the committee is about. And hopefully we beat Mr. Kevin Earle's estimate of 5 to 7 years, because I won't even have any kids at home by then. So I'd like to have us finish this. You know, I've got a kid in junior high right now. And so, but I think we will not be able to, as a committee at this point, to send something of this nature, because there's lots of discussion, words, ideas to be shared. I'm happy to be wrong. If there's others here that want to move that we send this on to the onto the board, happy to take a vote and do that. That's my take right now, though, is that we're going to have a lot more meetings before we're sending something like this to the board. All right, hearing no motion, we will continue to proceed as a group. And thank you again, Dr. Dubkin. Appreciate that. And you're on the right track that we all have the concerns. It's just now how to go about them. So thank you. Thank you. Mr. Edmondson and Ms. Briggs, nevertheless, you know, in the past, months ago, we were going line by line and doing that. Where did we leave off on our line by line? I've been pondering and trying to figure that out best I can, and maybe someone on the committee or someone on staff can direct us on where we stopped off such a good effort.
This is Lout. I believe, and I think my memory serves me well, I think you had assigned all the different specialties to kind of rewrite or edit or change or add anything to our different specialties or certificate or permits, I should say. For instance, pediatric dentist 1303, dental anesthesiologist, oral surgeons 1301, 1302 for maybe Dr. Snell and things like that. So I think that was the state that what you requested of us to do.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Lout. And yeah, and I know Dr. Beanstalk provided some that was sent out by staff to us this week. And so we've had some of that. So for the group for today, to be productive today, what do you recommend we do? How do we continue on the marathon that we've embarked upon and find success today and success going forward?
This is Ali Begay. I was wondering if maybe in the line by line, Dr. Beanstalk and Dr. Lout had sent us proposed changes to the 1303 language. I had sent proposed changes to the 1304 language. Could we take a look at those two documents and maybe go through and discuss what is in them?
Yeah, I see some moderate head nodding. So starting in order, you're saying 1303 and 1304, if I heard correctly?
Yes.
Okay. So if we can, hearing that idea, if we could look at 1303 and okay. See where that puts us as a group.
Well, I'm this is Lau. I'm happy to go through that. Dr. Beanstalk and me had discussed the changes. She had submitted some changes in green. I submitted some changes highlighted in blue. Our main concern was just for people that have not completed a residency program that want to do oral sedations, especially on kids less than 8. We wanted a special permit for that, and we like several of the states around us, we just recommended the requirements as far as hours and completed cases be presented when seeking initial certifications. So I kind of put that when I changed the different sections, that was the majority of what I did.
Okay. So in concept for the group, and thank you for that, Dr. Lout, what is this a direction that dentistry and licensing and, you know, and of course everything for licenses would be appropriate for us to make some changes on calling out that specific group?
Are they talking about just having a pediatric licensure for the 1303 permit only?
Well, I did it just because I'm a pediatric dentist, and that was the section that I'm more of an expert on and that my concern is for. I know our national guidelines, American Academy of Pediatric Dentists, has made some changes as well. I think this is kind of a problem in some other states of people that are doing oral sedations on kids that really don't have any training. They took 30 hours of CE, and then they're more or less licensed to do oral sedation. So I think a lot of states have increased the requirements like 60 hours. CE has to involve physical evaluation, medical emergencies, sedation guidelines, things of that nature. So I, with that in mind, that's why I elected to make recommendations to change our documents.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Lau. We'll get to you, Dr. Brady, in just one moment. So as I'm hearing this as a regular human, you're saying you addressed it in this portion of it, but overall what is best for the state is for us to have firm rules around sedation and training for those that are 8 and younger.
Correct.
And that your governing or your pediatric dentist association is recommending it based on the appropriate data, and nationally they're promoting that.
Well, they have not come out with recommendations to have a separate pediatric permit, but the people on the committee that wrote the guidelines, and I think I sent that out, or Sherry yeah. sent out the guidelines of sedation and monitoring of children. There's language in there that explains safety and things of that nature. I'm not an expert on the 1301, 1302, 1304. I know the oral surgeons have extensive training in intubation and airway management. I know from working with the dental anesthesiologists, they see a lot of pediatrics. The majority of their practice is pediatrics, and I know they've done a lot of cases. And I assume that the nurse and nurses have done the same thing. My concern is the oral sedation one with the guidelines and the requirements is pretty easy to get. And I think going back to what Dr. Dovkin said, and I think Dr. Blasek touched on it, the dentists really aren't equipped to do anything with they'll take a course, maybe a weekend course, maybe sit in on a few cases, things like that, and not really be aware of the needs that the young patient needs as far as anatomy, like Dr. German had said, the use of, they burn off oxygen quicker, and things of that nature.
Okay, so yeah, so you're saying that if the individual through their form of licensing, CRNA, medical anesthesiologist, or dental anesthesiologist, oral surgeon, if they have the training, great, have at it, you're allowed to be part of it. But a general dentist, come and make sure you have the right training.
Well, that being said, a general dentist, an endodontist, a periodontist, anything like that. I just, the other specialties that we've talked about have extensive training, and a lot of times they're based out of the hospital. I know speaking to Dr. Christensen, I know that if the child's really young, a lot of times they'll call in somebody like Dr. Brady or Dr. Brownstein, or else go to the Children's Hospital Complete Safety. So they have recognition of these different medical conditions that kids have, and they have the wherewithal to know where the proper place to have the anesthesia performed at is. I'm not sure what other people do, and I think this population, again, anatomy is different, the metabolism is different, physiology is different. I just think that you need a little bit more training than 30 hours of CE.
All right, thank you. And yeah, and part of our role as a committee with recommendations, the board with recommendations, is to make sure to best protect the public. And if it's allowable, there are some that are going to follow a allowable rule, even if it's not the right choice. But Dr. Brady, you had some take on this you wanted to share. Would you like to speak?
Sure. I agree. I tend to agree with what Dr. Lau is saying on all of this. And I think it's a good thing for us to look at. I know that ADA has actually taken it upon them to have a committee put together to address this concern. What do you do with the general dentist that does not have a restriction on their license in regards to being able to have sedation, oral sedation for the children that are 8 and younger? And so I know that their recommendations and their guidelines have not yet been published that I know of, but they are progressing. They have sent out to communities of interest to be able to comment on. And so I do see that forthcoming. And I also see the concern that Dr. Loud is talking about in other state anesthesia panels. And they're trying to address that same concern, because on one hand, they don't want to limit the general dentist from treating the pediatric patients with oral sedation. They just want to make those set of standards of how to obtain that permit. Maybe they're just revisiting that to dial that in just a little bit more.
If I could just interject and give you some information, because I do the 1303 permit evaluations. Most of the general dentists do not have any type of training to do oral sedation in kids. The ones that do have some type of specialty training, like Dr. Lott was saying, it's an additional training. They have PALS training. They have a knowledge of the working mechanisms of the drugs. the anatomy of a child is totally different than an adult. And I totally agree with Dr. Lott and Dr. Brady on this point that they don't have the skills in a course currently that's going to address those specific issues. So I think that having some more training in that particular area is certainly warranted. And that's coming from a person who actually does. I've done about 40-some 1303 evaluations, both pediatric and adult. The pediatricians or the pediatric dentists, well-trained. They have a specialty residency. The general dentists tend to not be. And the few that do it do have additional training. So I think that's a good requirement. Thought I'd just give you my experience.
What about, this is Christensen. I mean, it seems like we're talking about a couple different things here. I mean, if we considered somebody could get licensed for a 1303, or we could have a different numbers at this point, but just for adults, oral sedation for just adults, and oral sedation for children, and then maybe there's a combination of the two, you know, depending on the training and the hours and things like that. And that's just something that comes to mind as I hear everybody talking.
Well, if you look at it, a child is a totally different physiology. You're dealing with a different anatomy. It's much more difficult. And they don't give the training for the 1303 permit holders in pediatrics. They can obtain it. If a general dentist wants to, they can obtain it. They can obtain TALS training. They can get additional training. But it's generally not taught to get a 1303 permit. So if I go out to give a 1303 permit, what I have to do is ask them, do you treat children or do you treat adults? And if you treat, what's your age group cutoff? And I'll put that in the permit evaluation. You know, this particular practitioner stops at 18, 18 and above is all they treat, or if they're pediatric. I'm sure Dr. Brady will tell you and Dr. Lott will tell you that treating a child is a whole different mechanism and a whole different animal than it is treating an adult. You have a very small window of making a mistake in a child as opposed to a little bit more leeway in an adult. Anyway,
this is German. I thought in our last meeting, maybe Dr. Lott, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I thought we did decide to designate, have a P designation for those that wanted to do pediatrics. So there would be a separation and delineation of those providers requiring different training.
I think we did. I think what was up in the air is if we want it for each one of the different permits, whether we want it for a 1301, 1302, 1303, 1304. My perspective is again, oral pediatrics, the 1303, the oral sedations. From another perspective, I know that the other providers, obviously have extensive training. They have airway management, which again is important with kids and adults. And they've had hospital training, university training. They've done the cases. They've dealt with emergencies. They've done a lot where, I'm not sure if a designated permit for like a P permit for 1301 is really necessary. Again, that's my personal opinion.
So what little knowledge I have in the rule writing and changes process, we're going to likely need to address it throughout. And to staff, we can add some of the burden. We can definitely make a motion of a recommendation to the board, you know, as well, not even a recommendation right now, but we can put it into our total review as, you know, as a committee, we agree to this concept, and then we can allow some of the wordsmith to be done by professionals that do this. So those are options for us as well, is for us to agree in concept, which right now I'm not hearing any dissenting opinions of, no, please let me go and be poorly trained or have lack of training and go treat a six-year-old. And I know that I say that in jest. I'm not criticizing those individuals. Clearly, you're the ones that know the information.
Can I just make a quick comment? This is German. To Dr. Lau, and maybe I'm jumping the gun here, maybe there's more conversation needs to go, but you had mentioned maybe not having a pediatric designation for the 1301s. I think we should discuss that a little further. You had mentioned, you know, Dr. Christensen, when he does small children, does go to the hospital or does bring in a second provider to do that anesthesia when there's really no obligation whatsoever for him to do that. But I assume he's doing that out of consideration of the challenges the pediatric patient presents to him as a proceduralist and a potential anesthetist for that patient. So I would suggest that we open up a discussion at some point, whether it be today or in the future, about how to address those that patient population, the younger pediatric population, because you know, there may be physicians or dentists, oral surgeons out there who are unlike Dr. Christensen, who would want to take those younger children on their own and present a potential challenge and potentially even a poor outcome.
Yeah, this is Christensen. I will take kids to the hospital that need to go to the hospital. I've never brought in a second provider for a pediatric.
This is Loud. I think I might have confused you with Dr. Blasek. I know Dr. Blasek, you had brought maybe slight Jeff into your office at one time. So I think I just got the doctors mixed up there.
No,
Jeff, totally I haven't right. before. But like what I would say is I agree with Dr. German initially that I thought with last meeting that you and Dr. Beanstalk were going to create some verbiage for this, and then that verbiage goes up to the people who write it the right way. But to piggyback that with the idea that we should go into a discussion at some point or another, whether or not a 13-0 permit holder should have the P designation, I'm a bit adverse to a 13-01 having a P designation because, like that, I believe that we have the training for it. I think that what Dr. Herman is getting confused about is that sometimes we will take a patient to the ER or some will have someone come in and help us on it. But then there are also other times we look at the procedure we're doing and we look at the patient we're doing on and what type of anesthetic we're going to need. And they could be 4, they could be 5, or they could be 10. And sometimes we'll handle each of those cases differently because of our experience. So I would still mandate that 1301 does not need a P designation. If you're trained and skilled, as you've mentioned, to provide general anesthetics, and you've been trained to do it on pediatric patients, then you should still be able to do it. But I understand the difference between a 1303 permit. That's for an oral conscious sedation, and that's for an individual who typically does not have a level of training.
Hey, this is Ali. Just kind of moving back to, I think, talking about the additional anesthesia provider in peds is certainly a bigger conversation and one worth having. But back to the language here in the 1303.
We're not going down that road right now. We're not even talking about the additional provider.
Okay, good. Right. So to back to the 1303 language, I just had one recommendation and a couple of questions. One recommendation I have that we discussed a couple of meetings ago is in regards to end-tidal CO2 monitoring. I notice on this for monitoring equipment, Dr. Lout and Dr. Beanstalk, you added precordial stethoscope requirement. You know, I would suggest that we include end-tidal CO2 if we're achieving moderate sedation, whether it's pediatric or adult. End-tidal CO2 would be a good safety measure. And I did investigate before our previous meeting where we talked about it, the standards amongst all professions, both the ASA, the oral maxillofacial surgeons, the ADA and the ANA, and all of them recommend a moderate or greater depth of anesthesia that you have end-tidal CO2. So I would recommend having that in there. One question I had in regard to the number of hours required to get the 13-0P, and Dr. Brady, I think you're probably the best person to answer this. The document that you sent us on the spreadsheet, and by the way, I meant to say how much I liked you putting the state flags on the document. I thought that's a great touch. but looking at the hours in the sedation permits, the oral and enteral sedation permits by state, you know, is any of this specific to PD? I saw some notes about pediatric recommendations, but I'm looking at it. We're at 30 hours. Currently, if we were at 60, we would be the most hours required of any state. Am I reading the chart right, Dr. Brady?
Yeah, it's almost there. But yeah, that's correct. This is Brady. where 60, if you hit the 60 hours, you're beyond the same as Florida. And there is a state, and I don't remember which one it is, that is very exclusive that only limits that to a specialist. I don't know which state that is offhand, but I know there is one in existence that, that just outright does not allow it.
And these hours are for to include the ability to sedate children under the age of 8?
Now, the definition of the pediatric age is a little different state by state, but it's the ones that are highlighted, yeah, like in the pink. And okay, in some states, a lot of states are just silent on it. They don't have anything that they're saying on peds.
Gotcha. Oh, I see now. I know. I understand better.
So this is Loud again. In regards to the Entitle CO2, I think it's a great tool. In reality, in pediatrics, we try not to get to the moderate stage as far as sedation. But we've all bought a lot of those monitors. And to be quite honest, if the child's moving around, which we ideally like our kids to do when we sedate them, to move a little bit, it's hard for those to be real accurate in monitoring the CO2. And that's, I think that's why Lisa and me put that in the verbiage there.
This is Brady. I agree with Dr. Loud. I think the best ventilatory monitor for this purposes of what they're doing is definitely the retracheal stethoscope. That's really going to give them instantaneous readings back, whether they're breathing through the mouth or the nose, whether they're being obstructed, and actually putting it on a speaker for the whole entire team to hear and appreciate. It's very intuitive. You learn very quick, and so does your staff, whether someone's obstructing, not breathing, or have fluids in the airway. It's a very, very powerful and useful tool. And so, you know, if you wanted to say that they had to have capnography in case they slipped into moderate, hopefully, you know, I guess that might be like a little bit of a debatable topic. But when I see the pediatric dentist do an oral sedation, they're very, very well trained. They're very well in tune with feedback between the patient and themselves, whether the kid is crying or breathing. They have that ability to assess oxygenation and ventilation. But I'll leave that up to the plenty of peds on here to be able to comment further.
Okay. So for the committee, are we comfortable with the recommendations that are coming from Dr. Lout to have them be part of our package, that when we do present something back to the board to include these recommendations? Let's, so that we can follow some of the same order, let's, if I could hear a motion and then a second so we can vote.
I'll make a motion to include this language in our package that we propose to the board.
This is Blazik. I'll second it.
Okay, hearing a first and second. Any comments, discussion? I think we've had plenty, but if there's others. All right, so all in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, nay. All right. Hearing the ayes have it. Appreciate that. Thank you very much, Dr. Lout, for taking that charge, making those recommendations, and sharing them with us as a committee. And so on that, you know, thank you for addressing the pediatric section. So for the other sections, do we at this time have other prepared content that we should move to next?
This is Blazik. Christensen and I really didn't have anything as far as a 1301 permit that we were going to make any change on.
Okay, so a level of comfort there at this time.
I submitted language on 1304 that I'd like to review.
Yes. Oh, and that was where we were supposed to go next. my apologies. So, yes, please lead the charge. And maybe the battle, we'll see. But go ahead.
So the big packet, the 387 page packet, my red line changes start on page 81.
Thank you.
And what I did here was I, you know, listened to this committee and what you'd like to see as far as the ability to have some form of regulation over non-dentists that are providing anesthesia services in dental offices. And I also was considering the issue that I brought up with the board that it takes a significant amount of time for 1304 permit holder or permit applicant to have an on-site inspection. And that on-site inspection really is what creates the big delay in care. So what I did with this language, I changed a few things, some basic stuff, just using the term class four, which is something we discussed in the last meeting, changing 1301234 to class 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the main point of this was a way to make sure that the standard of care is followed, that dentists still held the permit, but that there didn't have to be a delay in waiting for that inspection. So in this language, what I created to have a class four sedation anesthesia certification that would be issued by the board or the board's designee to physician anesthesiologists and CRNAs that apply for it, that would go in and have an inspection either at a dental office or it could really even be at the board itself to show that the person applying, the applicant, had all of the necessary supplies, equipment, emergency medications that are required by the board that is in a 1304 office. And what this would enable is that physician anesthesiologists and CRNAs could obtain a certification from the board, and that a dentist who would like to have anesthesia services in their office could apply the same way they apply now, but that in the time between application and processing of everything in the application by the board staff, that they would not have to delay services to their patients as long as they only used providers that are certified by the board to work in the office. So it looks like there's a lot of changes here. I'll just add a bit more. Much of the red type that you see on pages 82, 83, 84, there it's a copy and paste for a significant amount from what the requirements are for the various permits already.
Okay, thank you. So you're saying these licensed clinicians that aren't licensed by the board could get a stamp of approval by the dental board to be part of a pool of individuals that could function and be able to practice under the 1304 permits and in conjunction with the dental office.
Correct.
Okay. Conceptually, Ryan, Mr. Edmondson, please.
Yeah. So a quick question on Mr. Begay's amendments. I noticed that like what you said, there's the majority of it, or a good amount, is a cut and paste. Would you, I don't know, are you proposing that we change where it starts if you look at page 81, or sorry, 80, under R411-1304, under A, and remove all of A, with the exception of some of the red line stuff you had, or does the red that you have on starting on page 81, is that also included in your other pages, 82, 83? The reason for the ask is because it looks like an entire rewrite of 1304 with some changes. Some are bigger, some are not. But it almost looks like there's a 1304 permit, and then under H, which is the first big section of the red, there's also then a class four. So it almost looks like there's two different permits from my perception. And in a rule writer's perception, I think that we're going to have the same question.
Yeah, that's a great question. The reason why I did not separate it out as, you know, its own separate permit per se, mm-hmm. is because it would be tied to the 1304. So a class four certificate holder. So let's say I have a class four certificate and there's a general dentist that applies for the 1304. They would have to sign an affidavit that before that they could only use a certified provider until they have an on-site inspection. And then the normal 1304 would be in place where they could use whichever CRNA or physician anesthesiologist they chose. So that's why I could see how it could be separated out as its own section. But it's tied together because the class four certificate holder would only be able to go into offices that the board has granted a 1304 permit. And it would be a 1304 permit with the restriction that there hasn't been an on-site inspection conducted.
So my perception was, and interrupt me, anybody that has, because I'm not a committee member, but I'm trying to seek a little clarification. My perception was that, and I don't know that we're ever going to get anybody to go from saying 1301 to class one and 1302 to class two, but especially if we also have a class four written within a 1304 existing rule, it's almost like we have a bifurcated process within this 1304 with this additional H that's delineated, some of it, as you said, copied. But it does draw a little bit of confusion, at least from my perspective.
So maybe if you look at C, where it says in the red, the requirement for an on-site evaluation may be waived by the board if the applicant attests to exclusively employ or work with a physician anesthesiologist or CRNA, recognize the board with a class four sedation anesthesia certification per subsection H.
Yeah, I would have to jump in, and I got your point there, Ollie, but with Ryan, it's a bit ambiguous. We're essentially saying we're going to change the name of the 1304 to the class four, and now you're creating another class four. So if anything like this was going to happen, I think it would be a class five or whatever. But beyond that, I would ask Ryan and our counsel, what real jurisdiction does the dental board have over CRNAs or medical anesthesiologists? And you might say, hey, this is a good idea, and I'll apply for it, get it. Your fellow CRNA might be like, I don't need that, and just go on their own. And which is what we found from Dr. Dubgen happened, I guess, in a recent occurrence. So, you know, I'm not sure what we have as far as a jurisdiction to enforce this on a body, CRNAs and medical analysts, that we have no jurisdiction.
Dr. Brady, you have a comment there, it looks like, if you would.
Yeah, I know that we've attempted to try to do a separate permit for Mississippi for non-dental licensed anesthesia provider in that category, such as a model that was taken on by California Board of Dentistry. And in that, there's some language that says we could permit these providers, but it's not a non-disciplinary action. We can only submit a permit to them and take away the permit, but it's still the action of their board to be able to discipline them. And so we kind of stepped out on a limb to do that with Mississippi, and we got a backlash from AANA and the representation in Mississippi that they did not like that at all. And I get where you're going with this, Ali, but it was very problematic in Mississippi. And we had the CRNAs at the time when we were writing the regulations, we had their support, but when it came down to actually going to implement the new rewrite of Regulation 30, what their old Reg 29 was, the anesthesia and sedation with it, The AANA did not want any governance on that at all. And so what we discovered is that you have to tie it to the dentist, and that vicarious liability is within that dentist himself to hold their license accountable. And so there's that 1304 conundrum. So I'm just here to give information. You know, I know California has a separate non-dental anesthesia provider physician subcategory that they permit, but we found it very problematic within getting acceptance from the AANA in Mississippi.
Right. Well, and I recognize that, and I agree with you, and the certainly becomes a challenge for the dental board to have any oversight of a non-dentist practice. And that is why it created, you know, this, as was stated, some ambiguity, is that it would be still tied to the 1304 permit. The dentist would still have to have, the dentist would have to have their own permit. And I might have created confusion by inserting the class four that the committee had agreed upon, but it would still be the dentist holding the permit, where the CRNA, that's, yeah. And I don't see why there wouldn't be, if there was an issue, that the board could revoke the certification, but yeah, they couldn't take disciplinary action against the licensure of the non-dentist.
Dr. Blazek.
So Ollie, that's contrary to what your document says and exactly what you just said. You said, so if he couldn't get his 1304 permit, we can just roll in because we already have this class four permit.
No, so that's not what the document says. They would still obtain a 1304 permit, but until they have the on-site evaluation, they could use a certified provider. So they would still have the permit.
So how many, times can they use the permitted provider before they're forced to have a 1304?
Well, that's the challenge. I've had dental offices that it's taken a year for them to have their on-site inspection. So it'd be until they can have an on-site inspection completed.
So then maybe your document, if we were to consider it, should say, upon application for a 1304, the dentist then has an opportunity to use a permitted provider.
Sure. I mean, that could be the verbiage. I mean, that's kind of the verbiage that I was trying to accomplish with what's in C. But if there's better words that could be used that become more clear, then I don't see any problem with that.
Okay. Dr. German, I think you were hoping to weigh in on this.
I unmuted myself and then I thought I don't need to say anything, but I agree. I think Dr. Blazek nailed the meat and potatoes of the conversation. This is an access issue, I think, that Ali's trying to get at. And rather than having an office sitting around not being able to service those patients, this clause or the effort I think that Ali is trying to portray is to get those patients taken care of.
Exactly.
And it sounds like the spirit of the intent in a CRNA kind of view is, if these patients need the help, don't hold it up for a year as you've seen at times. Allow there to be a certain group of non-dentist clinicians that could get pre-authorized, so to speak. You wonder, Dr. Brady, if it were presented that way in Mississippi, this is like above and beyond. It's not, yes, it is holding some accountability to other licenses in they lose this, you know, pre-ability. But maybe it would have played out differently in Mississippi if it were really in this narrow special privilege area.
Yes, it's right. Yes, I think that it was more of the fact of how do you investigate and take accountability and safeguard the public with someone that's not licensed or permitted. And we thought that we have an avenue for doing that with the permit that was just to the non-dental permit provider that would hold to the same standards and the same regulations, the same things that we have to do and implement as safety nets in Mississippi. And that's where they had a big issue with it. And to you know, the AANA said, you cannot regulate us. We even have different staffing requirements that address some of the concerns that Dr. Nguyen was talking about in an office for the actual staff, whether you're whatever level of sedation that you're doing, kind of the theme of what we're talking about with the pediatric endorsement. But they had an issue with that. You know, we put into regulations where they couldn't have, you couldn't just walk in one day and say, I've treated adults my entire life and now I want to do pediatrics. And we put in safeguards against that as far as currency and competency. The AANA had a problem with that too. And so there was no way to try to put someone on the same standard that was a dental licensed anesthesia provider than a non-dentist anesthesia provider, other than making them tied to a non-dentist permit, such as what is Arizona has established, or the other option was to limit what anesthesia could be done in the office by the level of permit held with the providing dentist, because it had to be tied to a dental license. So that's where it became problematic, where we thought we had an avenue to do this, but the AANA was adamantly opposed to any type of regulation, even if it met the same standard of regulation for a permanent anesthesia provider.
One comment I'll make regarding the AANA being involved and opposed to what was going on in Mississippi. The language that I presented to this committee was approved by the Arizona Association of Nurse Anesthetists Board unanimously. So the AANA will not be coming in and trying to say there's a problem with this after our state board already approved it.
Ollie, do we know why there's such a delay in evaluating these offices? I mean, why is it taking a year to evaluate these offices?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's not enough inspectors. I don't know if there's, it would be purely speculation on my part to try and come to some sort of conclusion on that.
Christian's
well,
in
I'll
here.
Tell you from, go ahead, please.
I have to agree with Dr. Brownstein about that. I mean, maybe we just need to look at who's doing these evaluations. I'm sure that a year is probably an outlier. I don't know what the average is. I mean, I think everybody has to wait their turn. Dr. Blazek, myself, and everybody else has inspections that there's a process that goes through. Maybe that's something that we need to look at and make recommendations to the board to help expedite some of these things. And maybe it will save us a lot of paperwork and changing of different things if we can find something that works and provides access to care in a more ready fashion. So
my personal perspective, this is Goodman here. I'm glad to hear that the intent as presented is to allow access to care to an office that is already in the process and going in the direction of getting the licensing. That helps because my worry as I started to understand some of this is that it was no, let me have the privilege so I could go anywhere. So I would imagine we would want to make sure there's protection here that if an office were inspected and turned down, or if an office withdrew or inappropriately delayed their inspection, that we would then say, sorry, you can't have this special, we're not going to call it class four, but the special individuals anymore because you're no longer on the defined path. Then the board, then the inspectors will have the ability to assess and control that inspection process as best as possible. In a COVID-19 year, process improvement for the intent of making things go faster seems like it's not as likely as other years. So the beauty of this committee, the beauty of what we're doing is we are making recommendations to a board who then will then have it debated, and then there's rule writing and there'll be recommendations. I mean, there, so it is a process and really on ideas like this where we can have general consensus being caught on the actual words isn't going to benefit us a lot because there's a lot of attorneys between here and there. Seth gets to be one of them, but there's just a lot of people that get paid by the word in the minute that will weigh in. So as a group, are we good? Dr. German, it looks like you had a thought or a comment.
Just a quick point. I don't go to dental offices, but I do a lot of dental anesthesia in the hospital. And as Dr. Lout may be able to testify, the biggest complaint is access and getting cases into the hospital is very bottlenecked. And so the ability to get these kids taken care of in the dental offices, I think, is extremely important. We discussed this briefly our first committee meeting when Ali brought this up. And the response from the, I don't remember who said it, but the response was that, you know, these examiners, site visitors are volunteers, as you know, and they have their own busy practices. And so they kind of get around to it when they can. So I think if we were to correct the issue on that side of the spectrum, it would be a systems issue that we'd need to address, whether that's motivation, incentivizing from a different perspective. But if we continue to just have volunteers go when they can go, I don't think the outcome will change.
And we can, as a committee, we can recommend anything. We can recommend the board for anesthesia to be involved. Everybody needs to eat bologna sandwiches. I recommend we don't recommend that, but we can recommend anything. So as far as this, we can cite that part of our discussions, part of what we found was that there's an opportunity potentially for the evaluation process to improve. You know, it's always difficult, you know, it, like you said, Dr. German, when you're dealing with government that's got limited resources and you're dealing with volunteers and you're dealing with all of it, it's going to be a challenge. And some issues will come back even after solved. So as a group, what we can do on this point is we could add it to our packet. We could share that as a committee, we support the concepts here, that we aren't fully tied to every word, but that these are the words as submitted by the CRNAs, and that as a group, we're good with supporting the concepts. How does that sound as an idea so that we can make some meaningful improvements here? Well, nobody jumped out of the screen. I got a few thumbs up. So if we could as a committee, I think as a chair, I'm able to make a motion. So I'll turn that into a motion. I'm sure staff will figure out the exact words there of that motion, but you get the idea. So that's the motion. If I could hear a second.
Second.
All right. Well, motion and second. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
And all opposed? And then we got, it looks like everybody's going rowing in the same direction on that one. So thank you. Appreciate the work on it and the discussion. And,
Mr. Goodman?
Let's continue to proceed. Yes, please, Dr. Blazer.
Staff comment for a moment. I saw Sherry come on for a second. I thought she was going to say something about the 1304 process, like how many are in the pipeline or how many have happened in 2020 versus 2019. Or are they able to comment on that and maybe what their opinion on the bottleneck was or is?
I'm not aware of what the bottleneck was. Once again, as staff, we do rely a lot on the volunteers to do those. I know Susie had provided a document within the packet as far as some timelines, date as far as how many days it has taken. And I was just looking at that. Let me pull it back up.
So that document was the applications. That wasn't the people who already have it.
So are you wanting to know the total numbers? You're asking?
Yeah, I didn't know. That's a good point. Like that document, I thought that was trying to tell me how many people had 1304s and acquire them in 2020. Well, that's inaccurate. That's how many have applied.
So you would like, I didn't do the document. Susie's sitting right here. Susie, can you address that, please?
Sure. So the question that was presented to me was, how long does it take from the time that they submit their application to their having gotten an evaluation? So that's what I delineated out, is that the date that we received their application until they got their permit. So when people are talking about it taking a year, there's a couple of cases where it took a while, but those cases were outlanders. There was, I don't know specifically to address the specific one that he's discussing because I don't know who it is, but they are volunteers. We're working with the doctor's schedule, the CRNA schedule, and they sometimes have different offices that are, you know, outside of the Phoenix general area. But the average is about 90 days to get the application, to get everything lined up, to get a hold of an evaluator. And then once I get a hold of the evaluator, I step out of it and let them schedule. And then they get back to me, let me know when the date is set. And then once it's evaluated, they send me the paperwork via email, and I generally can get the permit out. Usually within, I say within 7 days, it's generally closer to 2 or 3.
Yeah, and Susie, you would do an awesome job on your end. The delay is in the getting the inspection. And I will add just one piece. We have dentists that call us that have a patient that they'd like to get in. And once they hear how long the process can take, they'd never even fill out the application. So just looking at the applicants and the length of time, that doesn't show the people that end up not even choosing to complete and submit an application because they just can't wait that long.
Yeah, and you know, we're in a world where the microwave is not fast enough. My turkey dinner needs to be faster than the microwave can achieve. And so I believe, based on humans' patterns, that what Ollie's saying could definitely be running into some of our access to care problem in general, is they call somebody like him or someone else, and they say, hey, I've got this patient. They're told the truth of the future, and they don't do it. And then 3 months later, they call Ali again. Hey, I've got this patient. And it just becomes a comical runaround, or after the second, third time, just doesn't call anymore. And how are we helping humanity? I'll tell you, on this discussion, one of the things I was very pleased to hear is that in the access to care, and nothing against, it's a compliment, that Dr. German was seeing this as a positive to opening up access in general. I think that's a positive. I made my own decisions early on and thought, well, hey, if you've got an anesthesiologist that's doing this in the hospital, there'd be a lot of bias to have it be hospital-based, but glad to see that as part of the committee. And yeah, Susie, that's helpful. Thank you very much on that. And this will help address that, because in that phone call, somebody, a CRNA, could say, well, as long as we get you applied and fully applied, I'm able to provide the services during the application time, and then we'll go from there. So there could be some meaningful change. Susie, it looks like you have some other thoughts, ideas for us there.
Oh, no, I just wanted to explain the process.
Oh, okay, you can continue on if you'd like. Yes, please, if that'll help the group.
Yeah, once we get the application and everything is approved, then I move to get the evaluators. The evaluators, I get them in touch with the CRNA and the dentist, because the license goes to the permit goes to the dentist. And so it's up to that individual dentist. A lot of times the CRNAs is like, I want to go to, you know, Harry's Dental Care. Well, we don't give a permit to Harry's Dental Care. We give the permit to Dr. Harry. So sometimes that's a little frustrating that they want it, you know, right now. We have to look at the dentist and we have to look at the application that's in front of us. And it takes time.
Yeah. And yeah, we're not in any way discounting the work, and it's probably not going to, you know, it wouldn't help if we were more critical. Improvement. All right. So thank you for that. So as a committee, we've found some meaningful opportunities to make some good recommendations around two of the designations here. What do we have next?
I'll tell you, I think 2 hours on a phone call, pretty good.
Hey, look, I start
provider model.
We'll be here another 2 hours.
So you're recommending, Dr. Blazek, that we move on to kind of next steps, where to go. Dr. German saying, hey, the two provider model is part of what we should be discussing in the future. Or now, looks like you're ready. We may have to have you play the drums to help some of us stay awake there, though, Dr. German.
I don't think it's a long discussion. I'm not here to convince anybody, but I do think that the discussion needs to be had. Someone had sent, I guess Sherry sent those guidelines put out by the American Academy of Pediatrics and Pediatric Dentistry. I think we at least at some point need to address those guidelines. I don't think it doesn't have to be now if you don't want to, but I think we need to address those guidelines.
Well, I think that my opinion on the two provider model, because frankly, that's what it's going after, is what we do. There needs to be some serious research in our state, as it was done in other states, to show me that there's a problem. And if we show there's a problem with the one provider model in the state of Arizona, then I think I'm willing to entertain the discussion. But currently, we have nothing at hand. Even the 17 occurrences don't point to that. And so that's how I think for us to have a real coherent, intelligent conversation about the two provider model. That's what would be the basis, is to either use other studies or conduct one in our own state. And albeit Mr. Goodman mentioned, well, 17 occurrences, that isn't a whole lot, but if it's 50 and you have three states, or we know how many anesthetics that take place in the oral surgery office in the state of Arizona and how many occurrences occur, and we lean towards there's not much of a problem, then I don't really see the need for a two provider model in oral surgery. But if we're not going to have that study, or at least look at the data, then I'm not sure where the problem lies.
I agree. So I think the denominator is the key factor here that's difficult to address. I can provide an obvious denominator for the two provider model. That's easy for me to obtain. Maybe I can make a request and we can bring this up at our next committee meeting. You guys have access to your quality database, I would assume, the OMSQOR. I don't know if you could provide us data from that database as far as deaths that have occurred with that model.
Yeah, that's pretty easy to do. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And we could do it by a state, or, you know, just Arizona, or as far as the United States.
Perfect.
Go ahead, please, Dr. Christian.
What exactly do you have in mind, Dr. German? You brought this up just the second time you've talked about a two-provider model. I know you mentioned 6 months ago about what was on your mind about that, and obviously we have this recommendation that has no numbers, nothing associated with it all other than recommendation. But what did you have? What do you have in mind, and what is your issue that you're concerned?
We do have
so I think that
your red line. I still have your red line copy from last time. If you guys have your previous document, I think you put it in there pretty good, Dr. Germ, you know.
Yeah, I pretty much copied and pasted. I'll admit that, Plagiary. My intention, Dr. Christensen, is foremost, I think, just to discuss the guidelines. So we do know, and there's actually a lot of data to suggest that the number of complications that occur in young children under anesthesia is not really different in dental offices versus the hospital. So the number of complications is not different. It's how the complications are treated and therefore the outcomes that are different. And so there's a significantly higher rate of poor outcomes in office-based anesthesia under the single operator model than in a non-office-based anesthesia model where there's two operators. So that's well proven. The other thing is, you know, we have discussed, and I think we've shown, and we all agree that kids are much different. I'm speaking about younger children, right? 8 and younger, we can say 6, we can argue whatever, but children are much different than adults, and that's been a common theme in today's meeting. And so the question I think we need to ask ourselves is, does this difference, which all of our societies recognize and acknowledge from a sedation anesthesia standpoint, does it merit a different approach, a different anesthetic model? And that's where I think these guidelines have come into play. And so that's the discussion I want to have. I'm not trying to convince the committee one way or another, but I think we owe it to our patients to at least have this conversation, or at least to be able to say to the dental board that, hey, we addressed these guidelines that are supported by the dental anesthesiologist, the medical anesthesiologist, the pediatric dentists, the CRNAs, all of whom are part of this committee, right, that we at least address the issue. So that was my purpose in bringing it up, Dr. Christensen. It wasn't to, you know, cause rift or to pull out skeletons in a closet that I am finding more and more that I look into this exist between the Oral Surgery Society and the authors of this document.
One thing I would like to address about the AAPD document, and I think it would go along with your asking, Dr. German, is the idea of the anesthetic team. And I don't believe our statutes address that at all. And I think that's an additional item that should probably be added. Not sure how it gets worded or where it gets placed. But the idea of an anesthetic team, which all of us have agreed, is really important. And it's not just the doctor providing the anesthetic, and it's not just the dentist providing the dental care, but the book that we have there has an entire chapter on the role of the assistant. And oral surgery, we make a very big point in our, you know, what we call our office-based anesthesia guidelines about the role of the team. And I'm curious as to if, you know, the American Society of Anesthesiology has such nomenclature, or dental anesthesia. I'm sure you guys do, because you know, you're kind of our brothers in this thing. But I think it should be in the statutes, and that's like a whole new, maybe, I don't know, Roman numeral or whatever you call it. Go ahead. I'm done.
Sorry about that. I do know that there's movement on model legislation that's working in the background right now, and we've got our colleagues from oral surgery that is working on that to address such things as staffing and appropriateness with different environments. And I think actually being a little bit of the contributor of it, obviously I'm a little bit biased, but I do think that there is sound ground that every specialty can come to a consensus and provide some guidance on that. Unfortunately, it's not released yet. I don't even know if it's even appropriate to try to get the beta version, so to speak, out to this committee. But I can give you some underlying themes, and we can have that discussion. But I think it addresses the concerns that Dr. Germain is talking about, and also a lot of the concerns that Dr. Dufkin is bringing up too, with what he was talking about with the 1304. Unfortunately, it's not here today, but it may be something that we could look at in the future. But I do think it's something that's palatable to all specialties and to all forms of dentistry.
Yeah, Yeah, thank you for the discussion today. It sounds like it's going to be an ongoing discussion that we can have at the next committee meeting, that we can take into account the data that Dr. Blazek shared that he would be able to bring forward, and then we can have a meaningful discussion with that at the next committee meeting. As far as today, do we have any other items that we want to put forward as items to go into the next meeting, or any other things that we should discuss for this moment? Please go ahead, Dr. Brady.
Sorry, I burn up a lot of time. But in some time, and it doesn't need to be in the near future, but maybe way down the road, maybe as an agenda item, if we could just maybe revisit or look at things that we come into hurdles, especially from a medical legal standpoint, of what data we can extract from the board, the state board, which we always think is problematic because, you know, us, we're always trying to dig for information to look to have a better focus in the future. But maybe if I can maybe have 10 minutes of the committee's time just to talk about the FAA and what NASA has done to improve safety as a possible just way of entertaining maybe a potential model that may help in the future for reporting incidences of near misses. That's all. And it doesn't have to be anytime soon. It's not of importance of that nature.
Yeah, and we can plan that type of a discussion in the next meeting that we have. And I'm with you. There's a lot of things in kind of more that checkpoint manifesto type worldview that everybody in any clinical care could improve and learn from. So thank you. And so, yes, we can put that for the next meeting. Dr. Christensen had a comment first, Dr. Blazek.
Just briefly, I'm all for looking at a study. And I think that's something that needs to take place. I think that maybe we've kind of gone about this a little bit from the outside in, and where we should maybe go from the inside out, where I think a study looking at adverse events, I think that would help everybody involved if we're really going to look at safety and if things need to be changed or what we need to do. So I really proposing a study is done by the state. Happy to provide additional numbers as well that we as a society are happy to share. And I think that's where we need to start, honestly, before we really get down to what needs to change or if there needs to be any changes or we move forward with where we're at.
Yeah, let's put that as another discussion item for our next meeting is to what, you know, some framework of a study that we could ask for to be done and do that as part of that discussion. Thank you. And then Dr. Blazek, you had a comment, thought?
I'm only going to add to Dr. Brady that I think it'd be interesting for each of us, our specialties, to jump on with his NASA and aviation thing, what we are doing to try to improve safety. I know the anesthesiologist, you guys for years have led the way about self-reporting. I know ASDA, Dr. Brady, you've been very involved in creating that program that we can download on our phones. And I know Oral Surgery has a program. I think it'd be fun to kind of piggyback on your discussion with what each society is doing. And, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to create our own something here in the state as far as that goes, self-reporting.
Thank you. I like that.
All right. Thank you. And any other items for our next meeting? Okay. And then as far as Nick, go ahead, please. Brian. Sorry, my apologies.
I raised my hand, but we don't have the Zoom raise your hand, so I just had to do it.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
No, that's okay. So this is Ryan. I just wanted to let you know that I've been in contact quite a bit with, and Dr. Blazek and both Dr. Blazek and Dr. Christensen probably are aware of this, that I've been in contact quite a bit with the Oral Maxillofacial Association in Arizona. They want to come before the committee and do a presentation. They probably would have chosen today. I think that the turnout was greater than they had anticipated. At one time, we only thought that 6 people were going to be present for the meeting. But it turns out there looks to be quite a bit more. But they want to do a presentation before the meeting. This comes by their attorney that they've hired, Stuart Goodman, who will probably be present with somebody from the association. Obviously, Dr. Blazek and Dr. Christensen will probably sit still on this side of the committee's table, but probably still in favor of the comments that are going to be made from the association that they both belong to. So the comment is really just to state, and I'm assuming we're on the item 13, which is talking about future agenda items. So this will be on probably your next agenda. As we go through this as staff, it's super helpful. It's been a challenge, I'll admit, to coordinate meeting dates and times. Like I said in this comment, that they probably would have been here today had they known the turnout was going to be bigger than we had anticipated as staff. So when we send emails, if you could just quickly respond, hopefully we can try to get the biggest and best quorum that we can come up with so that people that are constituents outside will be better prepared to present information to you all who are making the decision. So I appreciate the time to comment today. And Dr. Brady, please don't feel like that you're taking up too much time. This is exactly the forum to have these comments. So I appreciate your time and your commitment to making comments.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Edmondson. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is German. Well, now I'm curious. Can we know the topic of discussion that the oral surgery board wants to talk to us about?
It's kind of along the lines what you were getting at, Dr. German, was, you know, what is our data points? And why do we think what we do is safe? And why do we feel the anesthesiologist provider model works in our hands? So it was basically around the topics that you're mentioning. So I think certainly maybe it's better for us to have a discussion as an organization or as a committee, I should say, before we have someone come out. But on the other hand, it was just something more organized that we thought we could present to you that would define what oral surgeons do across the nation as well as in the state.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Edmondson, definitely appreciate all the work you and your team are doing to make these committee meetings work. And we look forward to continuing them. Sorry about the change in staff. She did great work for the committee and for the board in general. So very sad to see her go, but that's part of what happens in any organization. So for the item of next committee meeting, we are going to send that out so that it will be done that way, like Mr. Edmondson shared. So if I can – go ahead, Mr. Edmondson.
Just a quick question. So originally when we met, the committee felt strongly that Tuesday and Friday afternoons worked best. some of the people aren't here to vote, not vote. We won't vote, Seth. But to state whether or not Tuesday or Friday afternoons still work best, is that still kind of the consensus of at least the folks that are present?
Like, I would put Tuesday number one. But if Tuesday didn't work and it had to be a Friday, certainly in the afternoon.
That's Tuesday afternoon, Ryan, that you're saying Tuesday afternoon or Friday afternoon?
Yeah, sorry if it was unclear. Tuesday or Friday afternoons.
Yeah, Tuesdays work great. Fridays will work if necessary.
Okay, so we'll continue to try to look for Tuesday and Friday dates that work on the board's calendar as well. And we'll shoot probably another poll, or not a poll, a doodle poll, I think that is exactly what it's called, to try to get the most members present.
One of us really should come up with a software that sounds better than Doodle, don't you think?
What's that?
We should really come up with a product that's better than Doodle for creating a poll for all meetings.
Let's put that on the agenda.
Yeah, can we make that recommendation to the board?
I just want to put a voice in for early morning. 5 a.m. meetings would be ideal for me, so just keep that in mind for any time that there's enough crazy people to go for that. So as far as do we need a motion for adjournment, or can we just hang up on each other?
Either.
All right. Well,
motion to adjourn.
We're going, yeah, second. All in favor, aye. All right.
Bye.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the collegiality today, for the help, and I'm glad we got some meaningful traction and got some things accomplished today, as well as some structure on things to accomplish at our next meeting. So definitely appreciate everybody and hope that you're well and you enjoy the weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. All right.
Bye, guys. Bye-bye. Have a good weekend.